call the February 13th, 2019 Landmarks Preservation Commission to order. Our roll call. Present in the house are Commissioners Bartoy, House, Johnson, Mortensen, Morgenroth, Stewart, and ex officio McClintock. I don't think I missed anyone. Are there any additions, edits to the consent agenda? Hearing none, are there any objections to moving forward with the consent agenda? Agenda. Because my eight-year-old would correct my pronunciation. Hearing none, we'll move the consent agenda forward by unanimous consent. We have excusal of absences from Commissioners Slessor, Sundstrom, and Williams this evening. We now have the approval of minutes from November 14th, 2018, and December 12th, 2018. Did anyone have any corrections to the minutes? Hearing none, does anyone have any objections to moving forward? The minutes. Hearing none, we'll approve the minutes by unanimous consent. There are two administrative reviews, just noting those during our time apart this last 2 weeks. 1015 North 10th and 2016 Pacific Avenue. And then we'll move on to our design review. First one being 818 North Cushman. Window replacements. So do we have a staff report?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is 818 North Cushman, which is a contributing structure in the Northville Historic District. It's up there on the screen. Built in 1925, this is a contributing property in the district. The owner is proposing to replace 11 existing windows, four of which are non-historic aluminum or vinyl windows. According to the Landmarks Commission bylaws, upgrading non-historic windows does not require a full design review. Anderson 100 windows are proposed for the non-historic windows. The remaining seven, including two sets of pair double hung windows, are original. The owner requested a bid from Legacy Renovations, which is attached to the application for restoration of the original windows. This estimate exceeded the owner's budget and desired time frame. Some of the windows are painted shut, do not function. They also contain lead paint. The owner is not able to complete the restoration work herself and therefore is requesting to replace them with Milgard Essence windows, which have wood interiors and fiberglass exteriors. The original wood trim will be retained and repaired in kind as necessary. At the request of staff, the owner also provided a photographic survey, and the window specifications are also included in the package for both 100s and Milgard Essence. There were some questions from the commission ahead of this meeting that I just wanted to bring to the commission's attention. First of all, there was a request for the budget comparison between Legacy's estimate or bid and the replacement windows. It was approximately $25,000 for restoration with Legacy, and the new window budget is $14,000. The second question is the configuration or design of the replacement windows and what they're going to look like, because there was a lot of window specs in the package. And the intent is to match the original where possible, which means configuration where it was double hung, divided light sash, and so forth. And then the third thing is there was a question about Anderson 100 windows and Milgard Essence windows and which goes where. The non-original windows are going to be replaced by Anderson 100 windows. That's a Fibrex composite window manufactured by Anderson. It's a through-and-through composite window, so it's not a clad window. And then the Milgard Essence is what is proposed for the existing original windows, and that is actually a wood clad or some wood interior clad with fiberglass in the exterior window. It's considered, it's a bit more expensive than the Anderson 100 in terms of cost, and so it would be considered a higher grade window for historic replacement. And so that's the difference, and those are just some of the questions that came up. The action requested was the approval of the described scope of work. The standards that apply are the design guidelines for the North Slope Historic District for windows. I'm not going to read those all into the record. Just require anything. The staff's analysis, this property is a contributing property with the district and is subject to review by the commission for alterations, including window replacement. Secondly, the applicant is proposing to replace all the existing historic and non-historic windows. Replacement of historic wood windows is not recommended according to the district design guidelines unless the windows are significantly deteriorated. Item three, although the windows could be repaired to operability, the owner received a bid that is not affordable, and they are unable to complete the work themselves. Item 4, the window survey does not appear to show significant deterioration. Item 5, the proposed replacement windows meet the district design guidelines for replacement materials and are a close visual match to the historic windows. And item 6, there is no requirement to upgrade non-historic windows and replacement materials, and this is not required for design review for non-historic windows. So the recommendation is staff recommends approval of the replacement of the historic windows and defers a recommendation regarding the replacement of the windows based upon the documentation submitted.
Thank you. And Jamie?
Yeah.
Bresma?
Bresma.
Jamie Bresma, is there anything you'd like to add?
Sorry, I didn't hear that last part. Is it the
Oh.
What were you saying?
What I was saying, or what he was
what
saying?
You were saying at the end, it was approved, or?
Yeah. Oh, staff is recommending approval of the replacement of the non-historic windows and defers a recommendation regarding the replacement of the historic windows based upon the documentation is submitted. So it's not an approval. The commission will make that decision.
Okay.
Usually, if there's anything you wanted to add.
No, nothing additional. I got some questions from Ruben today that I answered.
Okay, great. So I'm going to open it up now for questions and comments from the commission.
Okay,
question, Johnson.
Why are you doing this?
I just recently purchased a home, and as much as I would love to keep the original windows, I can't afford to restore them, nor am I a specialist in that area. The house has about 3 different areas of the home that have been renovated over time. There's some vinyl windows, there's aluminum windows, and then there's some original, which are covered in many, many layers of paint. They don't operate, and it's chipping off. And I have a job, and this house has become sort of my second job.
Yeah.
I think the window project would become my third job, which it's not something that I'm skilled enough to do, nor can I afford to completely restore them as much as I would love to. But
is it a matter of energy conservation?
It's a matter, a little bit of that. It's also that I'd like the house to have all the same style of windows. I'd like them to match. The aluminum I'm planning to bring back into the style of the double hung look and feel that was original to the house. So it's a number of things.
Okay. So one of the questions that I had was in your pictures that you provided, which are really great, I really don't see any deterioration at all on the windows, and you've got what look to be original storm windows.
Yeah.
Which is amazing, and which are you planning to keep the storm windows, or are you planning to get rid of the storm windows?
Well, I'm hoping. I'd like to keep them. I'd like to restore mm-hmm. the trim on the outside as much as possible, and then keep those if I can. This is probably the best view of the deterioration. It would probably be the front windows. Yeah, you probably have to zoom in on that one, but...
I mean, I've seen lots of deteriorated windows,
yeah.
And those don't really show any deterioration, or very little. They may be not operable, as you point out, and so forth, and it may be that you could get a contractor for even less than the $14,000 to replace them, to open them, to get them functioning again.
Yeah.
But if they've had storm windows over them, I find it really difficult to believe that there's much deterioration of those windows. I don't know, that's...
Well, looking at this picture, it looks basically like paint deterioration. I don't see any rot in the corners. The storm windows certainly protected the exterior, and if there's lots of moisture on the inside of the house, that would make the paneling worse.
Yeah.
And the putty line on the bottom of the left pane there looks sloppy, but that's an easy fix. I just don't see any reason to replace them, especially since you have storms. Storms make them much more thermally efficient.
Mm-hmm.
Than just by themselves.
Sure.
And it's been proven, I wish I had the numbers, that just replacing a window with a double pane glass really doesn't increase the efficiency very much. The real problem is infiltration of air through the gaps around the window. So weather stripping is very, very important. And around the whole house, just the air infiltration will make your place warmer. But to spend that much money and not get any real results other than a look doesn't meet our criteria.
So you're saying that you don't think I'd gain any energy efficiency from the
very little. Because it's doubtful that those storms would fit the new. I don't know. It seems unlikely.
So did Legacy, they said that they were very deteriorated, or is that just, because I looked at the same kind of windows and I thought mine were completely shot, and it turned out it was just the paint that was actually in great shape. The guy told me, the window repair guy, but so they actually thought they were rotting out in certain places and stuff, or?
Most of the rot is on the south and east side of the house, on the outside trim. Where there's a lot of those putty lines where there's been repair in the past. Inside, it's mostly, it's a lot of paint chipping and that type of thing. And I, again, I know there's lead paint and all of that. There's many, many layers of paint in there. So the cost, I think that's part of it too. A lot of these companies will come in, and if they're going to go ahead and do a restoration for you, there's always an LED, lead pipe.
How many windows? I'm sorry. I'm sure that they was it four. How many windows would they be restoring?
There are five with the. I don't know how you guys consider it. There's two sets of two double hung next to each other. So I don't know if you consider that one bay or if you consider that four.
Yeah, just each window, like each double hung. I guess I was just curious.
Two, three, four, five.
Just yeah. It just seems really, really a high estimate for only, because I had the same divide different company estimate done, and it was for six windows, and it was closer to, you said, anywhere between, you know, 5,000 and 7,000, depending on once they get in there what it is.
Right.
I don't
The Legacy bid that Troy provided here is for a full restoration. So it's complete stripping, sanding,
removal of the window.
Take the glass out, reset the glass.
So
it's a full.
Gotcha.
And,
okay. Yeah,
and
a lot of work.
That's what they would ordinarily say they would do, you know,
right.
Unless you came in and said, we don't want to do that.
Right. The
guy
that I guess, yeah, I didn't get a quote for actual sanding and painting of the boost to make them operable and shore them up.
Right.
Yeah, it's a lot of work, yeah.
So that would be a full restoration of the windows, and to get these operable, and I think to get them weather stripped, and similarly with the storm windows, you know, you could probably do that for half of the cost of the replacement. I mean, obviously you would need to talk with some contractors, but that's contractor work, and it's not. You know, replacing the windows, it's not restoring the windows, it's just getting them operable and getting a good paint job on them and so forth. So, I don't know, other commissioners might have other opinions.
Do you know if, like, the weights and stuff are all, and the ropes are all still there?
I think, well, I can't operate them, so I can't really tell, but we found a few weights in the basement that maybe were from one of the windows that was replaced, I don't know. So I'm not entirely sure if they're completely intact on the inside.
Well, usually you can see a rope above the lower set.
Yeah, the rope is there, but it's painted.
Pulley.
It's all painted as part of it, so even if, I don't know if it functions or not.
But it's not a hard thing to do. You take the stops out, the window comes out, the rope comes off, and then you can new ropes in.
They can be painted too. I think it's still work. Minor painting, focus.
up and down a few
times. Up and down a few times with some lead paint, but you know. Yeah.
But a painter can handle the lead paint without you having to shut down the whole house. And re-glaze, even. Some painters will glaze. And put on a good quality job, and it'll be good for years.
But I don't have any problem with you upgrading the aluminum ones.
On those. And one of your reasons for doing this is so that the windows look consistent throughout the house.
Right.
So if you replace those non-historic windows with something that looks like what's historic, then you've got that look without having to spend a fortune on the other windows.
Is there any further questions, comments from the commission? I guess it's just here now. I was just going to say that keeping in mind the guidelines, I think, are important as we move forward, and the consistency of how we've looked at windows previously, and some that have appeared more deteriorated than this, I know, have come before the commission, too distant past as well.
So I guess I have a question both for the applicant and the commission, is whether it would be possible or useful to find out if there are folks out there that can provide the service, that is cost effective, that she can bring on, and at least provide that, either take that path or provide that number to the commission if it's worthwhile to take another bite of this. So what I'm saying is, maybe if the commission, or you thought that you or would be willing to go out and try to find another contractor, another bidder to provide you with a number for your consideration,
mm-hmm.
The commission would defer the action on this application for the time being. And when that information came back to them, if you still wanted to proceed down the path you're on, given the additional numbers that you have, then they could consider it at that time, or you could take the bid for restoration if it was acceptable to you. So basically what it would be is an action by the commission to defer this pending additional information about the scope of work and cost.
Getting additional bids.
That's right. So I just throw that out there. Sometimes people just want a decision, sometimes the commission just wants to make a decision.
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly open to getting other bids. The other people I talked to, there's quite a line for people doing that kind of restoration in that detail. I'm sure there are other people that do it, and I'm open to that. But again, I also want to keep moving on my project. So
yeah.
If I would be happy to do that, if there's anything that we can cover via email, that would be helpful to me. But if I have to continue to come back to the board meetings, that might be a challenge, because I'm from Seattle and I don't live in this house until I get heat. So
I think that you said
I have no heat.
the non-historic windows would be something that the administrative approved anyway, correct?
Normally, yeah. If there was nothing else in the scope of work, the Anderson window replacement would be something that we would just do at the staff level.
Okay.
So we can do that if that's,
Yeah, and because I think the concern, is that this, from what I'm hearing from the commission, it seems like the Cadillac option of
yeah.
That's the wrong term. That's like my, whatever is the modern Cadillac version that we have here, and kind of seeing that range, especially if one of the considerations you're asking us is kind of a financial hardship to be able to see that, and some of the comments made by commissioners maybe, makes it functional, deals with the pain problems, those types of things.
Yeah, and one of the reasons I went to Troy is Lauren mentioned that he has come before the board in the past, and he actually used to live kitty corner to the house that I bought, so he knows the area well, and he knows the work well, and so that was one of the reasons I went to him for a bit. So
and he does excellent work.
Yeah.
And
that's what I've heard.
His proposal is exactly what I would expect to see, but
yeah.
I think that as other commissioners here have suggested, possibly talking with a paint company, a quality paint company, could possibly do a lot of the work that you're looking for on these windows. There may be a few places that is beyond what they would want to tackle.
Sure.
But I think a lot of it might be stuff that they would be willing to look into. So we might take that route as well.
Sure.
So I mean, we could move forward with a motion on the non-historic windows or let them be administratively approved and then defer on the historic.
That's fine. And pending, I mean, we can discuss this from the meeting to the next steps on after that. Mm-hmm. If you have additional numbers you want to furnish to the commission, whether or not you come back in here, if there's additional action to be taken or not, we can figure all that out. So
okay.
I don't think you're required to be present, you know, at the meeting.
Oh, okay.
If we're considering it, I mean, it's kind of helpful if there's questions and that, but there's no requirement that you come before us again, especially if it's a travel hardship.
Okay.
So, do you have a preference? I'm looking. I would look for a motion that we actually. I mean, if we had a motion just to defer the entire package, then I think staff could actually administratively approve the non-historic.
What I would advise is making a motion to delegate the non-historic windows to staff and defer the remainder of the application pending additional information regarding bids to consider something to that effect until that information is available.
Does a commissioner have some kind of thought similar to that of Mr. McKnight that might be moving forward in their head?
I would actually like to make a motion.
Fantastic. Commissioner Johnson.
I move that the Landmarks Preservation Commission defer the application for 818 North Cushman Avenue pending submittal of additional information, and that the non-historic windows be remanded to staff.
The motion by Commissioner Johnson. Is there a second?
Second
by Commissioner Stewart. Is there any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll move to a vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? The motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And then Jamie can just work with you, right, Ruben? Thank you so much. So the next design review we have is for 1220 North 5th. Michael Borgorosels.
Mike's on vacation.
Mike's
on vacation.
Okay, you can come up if you'd like. Or
sure.
Do we have a staff review?
Yeah, I'm just going to catch up here with...
Safe travels.
Yeah. So item 3B, 1220 North 5th Street in North Slope Historic District. Again, this is built in 1906. It's a contributing property in the district. The applicant is proposing 17 solar panels on the side of the roof facing, North M Street, but actually on the side roof, the side gable facing directly North M Street. This location is partially visible from the street, and staff requested that the installation on the side of the roof that faces only the backyard to be explored. And so there are two configurations that were shown in the packet. There is this first one right here, which is the initial submittal, and so you can see M Street along here, and this is the front of the house right here. And then the second submittal, this is showing a view sim right here. And then the second submittal is showing the way they were reconfigured to reduce the visual impact, and that's the second view sim right there. Visuals showing both options are provided in the packet. The corresponding conduit line and mechanical equipment will be located on the rear of the home behind the fence. The conduit comes in metallic gray, but could be painted to match the home. The action requested is the approval of the above scope of work. The North Slope Historic District Design Guidelines apply to this, and there aren't any that are specifically about solar panels in the design guidelines presently, and so really the guidelines that apply most directly to this are those for roofs, including preserving and maintaining existing roof form and appearance, and that's really pertaining mostly to the overall roof form, and then the additions to roofs, and the example given in the design guidelines is skylights. But additions be sensitively located. And so the staff's analysis, the property is contributing and it is subject to the Landmarks Commission review process. Item 2, the existing roof form is not changing. Item three, the panels are sensitively located towards the rear of the home, the second option, that is, which is minimally visible from the right-of-way and could also be removed without harming the historic character of the home. The existing roof height is being maintained, and they are clearly differentiated from the historic materials on the home. And staff recommends approval of the application. The second option is the one that is most compatible with the house. And I conclude my staff report.
Great, thank you. Theodore, you said?
Stephen.
Stephen. I don't know where I got the authority.
Okay.
Okay. Do you have anything to add?
I was here to field any questions you guys have. Obviously, the Mr. Keener and Mrs. Walsh would opt to have them in the more visible area, not because of the visibility, because of the actual solar production. You'll notice that the tree it basically is about a 4% production difference, which doesn't sound like a lot, but over the course of 25 years, it's a pretty big substantial financial investment. So I'm here basically to be their mouthpiece. They would prefer to have more production, but it'd be more visible. Obviously, ultimately, it's your call. Both of them would work, for sure. They're great panels. They all have microinverters, which augment shade very well. But obviously, you want the most production as possible. So,
thank you. I'll open up for questions and comments from the commission.
I'm curious about how far off of the roof do they mount?
There is. There's about 4 inches. It's on the same plane, but you need air to be able to pass the amenity panels. So you have cooling off the back of the panels also for debris and for precipitation, stuff like that. So you have a bit of an air gap.
Okay.
And also, it'll keep the upstairs much cooler because you're going to have that buffer.
Right.
Added benefit. And the roof weathers a lot slower when panels are covering it. No moss grows under them either. Can you tell I'm a design consultant?
With the tree next to it, does it get a lot of debris?
It'll get more debris, for sure. I could tell a difference from one side to the other. That side definitely, I mean, not just the shade, definitely more debris, definitely more potential for... panels are pretty beefy. They're tempered glass, but I mean, anything closer proximity to a large tree like that, that's just a numbers game at that point, if there's any issue. Not to say that, you know, they couldn't be stewards and have it arbored up a little bit, but like I said, both of them would be just fine. Either one of those arrays would totally work. Obviously, there's one more production possible.
So, could we go to the slide that shows the second arrangement?
So it's the original.
No, this one.
This is the one that was submitted after our staff review.
Yeah. That's the one I want. That's the one I want. So, here's what I'm wondering. So to get your production, you're talking about?
Solar production, yeah.
Solar production.
Mm-hmm.
So these three panels are the ones, or would it
that
be
whole corner, yeah.
This corner right here. So I'm wondering if, because you've already got some of them over here on the other side of this gable, if you put two or three of those panels over here and sort of fill this out a little bit, since we've already are coming down here, would that help your production?
Sure. I mean, if you're looking at any of those to the other side, it was going to increase your production. Maybe 1-2% for each panel, depending.
So you're thinking about
sort of filling in, slipping one here and slipping one there, kind of, and making this your sort of datum line.
Yeah. So you're suggesting moving two panels over, basically filling that gap?
Two, possibly three.
Well, two would only two would fill in that gap to make it a straight line down, and that's all that would fit in that. If you'd have your second row down, would fit two. You wouldn't be able to fit three because of that dormer.
Okay.
So you'd be able to fit one there and
one below
on the main. So you'd be able to relocate two and keep that line. But then again, you would have an uneven array on the other side. We try to keep things, I guess, congruent as possible, as aesthetically pleasing as possible. Once you start piecemealing things like that, I mean, you won't see as much.
Here's my point, I guess, is that you're already piecemealing on the side that's most visible?
Minimally, yes.
But minimally. So I'm less concerned about the side.
Gotcha.
Piecemealing on the side.
Okay, fair enough.
It's less visible. So.
Sure.
Why take them away from the non-productive side? Why not just add two panels to the productive side?
That's the system size they wanted to go with. That's the system size that I designed for them according to their power production or power usage versus production. I have a spreadsheet with about 200 macros that I plug in all their information, all the shade analysis. This is the sweet spot size system for them. And this is in their budget.
That's what they purchased, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's the main thing is their budget. I mean, you can design a system as big as you want, but everybody has a budget, too.
Did you say the payback on this is 25 years?
Oh, no, no, much less than that. No.
Well, I've been waiting for this application for years. Solar panels on a historic home that's actually coming before the commission.
I was curious how this would go through.
So, hoping to hear more from other commissioners.
I think personally it would look better to have it be even. I mean, it's you're getting that on each side. You're going to see it already. Why not have it just be look even, you know, on each side? Personally, but
that's the original.
I guess that, yeah, that's just my. You're going to see it anyways. That's like all front loaded. Mm-hmm. You took a few more and put them over and made it
right to make them more congruent.
If you took these three here. And another one. Two here and one here or something, or one here.
Get a little closer.
And two there, then it would just be a single
row. Basically split the array, make it look as congruent as possible. I can work up some other configurations if you like. That's just a matter of a click of a button. Do you want just a couple different layouts to give you guys some other scenarios to look at? Or?
I think probably what I would suggest, if it's all right with the commission on this, is if you provide the applicant and staff with sufficient guidance to understand kind of what the commission is going for, then, or what's tolerant. If you're inclined to approve it, then we can just take care of it from that point.
Sure. And I've been CC'd on all the emails, so yeah. I'm including everything, so that's fine.
So I don't want to jump into, but what I'm hearing then is sorry, go ahead.
Is there any point at the street where you would actually see both sides at the same time?
Not particularly. The height of the building and the fact that the building next to it is pretty tall. You have to walk down the street. See that arrow that comes down right there? That's the best spot you can actually see the array from. We walked up and down the street and took a bunch of different vantage points. That's like kind of the most visible view. You really can't see the other side much from the street at all.
It's a very large four square next door.
So I'm not sure it matters if they're
congruent
matched,
or not.
If they're
it would help the production though if it was.
Well, I guess it's interesting that we haven't had this in the guidelines. I think it's something that we need to think about adding to the guidelines because it's probably the future, hopefully, you know, that
hopefully
things like this would be happening. I mean, personally, you know, for me, I don't necessarily think solar panels detract from the historic character of a building. They're obviously something new. They're removable. You know, it's not a permanent, as long as they're not covering up some type of, I think, characteristic of the home. That's kind of my opinion.
I was just going to say I appreciate Commissioner Johnson's comment. And just to be perfectly honest, I have two houses that are individually on registers, and I've been thinking about panels on one of them or the other, so I'm curious about this myself. So having said that I might have a prejudice, very obviously, but not coming before this commission, I do wonder, this is the same point that the chair was just making, is this significant enough to detract from the historic appearance? We don't rule, and this is a very minor example, we don't rule on television discs, I can't think what they're called.
Satellite
dishes. I mean, this is much, much, much larger. I'd be interested in other commissioners' opinions. I frankly don't know. I'm a little uncomfortable with it, but it's not the same thing as replacing windows or putting new siding on, so I'm somewhere in the middle on that. What visually does it do? As you just said, they're removable. They match the plane of the roof. They are, but they are above the plane of the roof, and they are quite obviously something modern. We don't rule on changing roof materials typically. Can't think of anything more coherent to say.
Well, I would have an objection to take my house for example. If we decided to put panels right along the front, so that it would, from the sidewalk, you would that's just exactly what you would see. And I think this is, particularly the second option here, it's very sensitively done. Most of them are, given the way the house happens to be situated, most of it's not going to be seen unless you're actually looking for it. So I think I certainly wouldn't be opposed to it. But it's very similar, as Ruben pointed out, to skylights, which we do review. And we make the same kind of sort of rule of thumb with those. We don't disallow them, but we say put them where they're not very visible from the primary facade.
And I completely agree about the skylights, and certainly if I was going to be doing it, I'd be putting it on the rear facade, which is an option I've got, but I don't. I can see what's going on here.
And I think, I mean, that's one of the issues now, because we're dealing with something that you really, you only have a minimal amount of choice about where you can place these. You know, I mean, it's not as if you could put them anywhere you want. There has to be a, you know, I mean, I guess it's balancing that, perhaps.
There isn't a garage, for example.
Well, I would actually be fine with option one, as someone who's very concerned about energy efficiency and moving toward technologies that reduce our effect on the planet. And I see this as less intrusive as a skylight, because you're not affecting the actual materials of the roof or the historic materials of the rafters and the things. So I certainly wouldn't oppose other commissioners preferring the second option, but my personal opinion is I'm okay with the first option.
I would agree with that as well.
I guess so, and I guess just to kind of play devil's advocate, because we were talking, I think almost every commissioner was talking about, you know, moving a few panels here and there. Does that actually do anything when you compare it to the first option? You know, does that make such a big difference between, say, this option, where I assume that you've maximized this for solar production?
Correct.
That's so anything that deviates from this is going to actually lessen the amount of production overall.
Yes.
You know, I guess, is there that big of a difference, say, between this, where you're looking at that, and this with those additional panels coming over? I mean, it'd still be visible.
I would argue that there is. And although, in general, the four square next door hides much of it, it is, that is, that side of the, of that gable is a primary facade on the primary street there, North M. And I think that, again, using our usual guideline, which is to minimize things like this on those primary facades, it would be better to reduce the number that are there rather than have the full array coming out to the edge of the roof line there.
Well, I just wanted to point out, I think, just for sake of discussion, that there seems, I think the one that goes all the way out here, there looks like there's three more courses, or three more columns of them, is that right? So the first option here, well, maybe two.
Three.
Yeah, so there's, so what I'm hearing, just because I want to kind of recap and as the discussion moves along, is that there seems to be some comfort level, at least, with at least having another column of them on here, if there's not a comfort level with having them run all the way out to the front of the roof edge, you know, or some desire to allow a few more at least on this side, that seems to be within the general comfort level of everybody. Although their commissioners Mortensen and Morgenroth don't have an issue with the initial proposal at all, just for sustainability reasons. And physical impact reasons. So I just want to recap that.
No, it is, and I think I stand with the commissioners don't have an issue with the first as well. I mean, for the same reasons that we've stated. But if it's a matter of comfort, I'm not sure what. We're in some sense, I guess, setting precedent here. If this is the first one to come across, and it's a good discussion. I mean,
nothing wrong with being a trailblazer.
It's good.
So I do have a technical question for you. Mm-hmm. Since all those panels in the first proposal and the second proposal, mm-hmm. they're all on the same plane facing the sun at various times at the same angle. Mm-hmm. And so I guess the little dormer that's on the long side of the house mm-hmm. would cast a shadow on those lower panels in the second version in the winter.
Yeah, sweeping shade. They would cause a little bit of sweeping shade, but pretty minimal. Yeah. Pretty minimal. So like I said, they do have microinverters, so they're all autonomous.
During high season, during the summer, that whole roof will be in full sun, right?
Yes, except for the morning, because that tree does have sweeping shade every morning year round. That
the tree
affect,
or the house?
The tree.
The four square next to
the four square really doesn't affect it. It's the tree. That's the main thing.
The big fir tree?
Mm-hmm.
That's to the north and west.
Right. It still causes
that's
that. That thing is tall.
Sun.
That's still tall enough to cause sweeping shade.
In the afternoon.
Get my bearings. Morning.
Well, where's north?
Straight up. Yeah, east to west.
Yeah,
so you're
north and west.
Right, and your sun comes across your bow in the morning, so you're going to get morning shade from that tree. I've been doing solar for 17 years. I know what's causing shade.
I've been watching the sun for.
Okay. Okay. Well, I do know that it. I knew that it. So
then.
Just let me quantify that. Okay. Okay. Sun rises in the east, sets in the west. On this latitude, solar south is actually 165, not 180 magnetic. Okay.
Yeah.
So you're 15 degrees off. Okay. So sun coming across your bow here, morning shade. Make sense?
In June 21st. It would create shade.
We take solmetric shade readings. We take a fisheye lens picture and tells you what time of day, what time of year gives you shade. We have a program that breaks it all down.
I've used
it. Okay, I've been doing it for a long time. That will be morning shade,
okay.
Sir.
Well, my whole point is it really a big difference between the first and second?
Sure, 4%. Mathematically, 4%. Over 25 years, yes, it is significant for this kind of investment. I'm here to fight for them to get the most production. I love solar. I live for this. I've been doing it for a long time. So both of those scenarios work, obviously. They're really efficient panels. They're the most efficient panel in the world. They do have microinverters that augment sweeping shade. They have bypass diodes on every single cell, so they're all autonomous. But that 4% is still 4%.
Okay.
So long story short, they'll both work.
So is the maximization between the two, I mean, when the commission was talking about throwing 3 to 4 panels onto the other side of the dormer. I mean, is that going to recover that 4%, 2%?
It'd probably get you about 2% more. Anything moving them over would get you more. I mean, it's just a matter of figuring out the math once you shift them over there. Probably 2%.
Okay.
I mean, it doesn't sound like a lot, but like I said, over a long time, it does add up. Sorry, I'm very passionate about solar.
That's good.
And I'm Italian, man. I talk in my hands.
He's very passionate about the sun. is there any more? Because I feel like we're kind of discussing the same thing. I kind of feel like the commission is probably moving to a rarity in this case, maybe even a vote that isn't unanimous.
One more question.
Sure. Lay it
can
on.
Can the panels be tiptable
you
to
don't
face
do that.
The sun more?
You don't want
to
do that. No, that looks terrible. And it's like a big wind shield. It's a big drag. They're designed for 110 miles an hour, our mounting procedures, our solutions are, but it just looks terrible. That's the aesthetically, it looks. You don't want to do it.
Okay.
You don't want to do it. It really would. I've seen all kind of people that drive different, and it doesn't look good. We keep them on the same plane.
Solar farms.
The one other thing on this.
Oh, ground arrays are different.
Yeah.
Sorry.
On this image, is this representing some kind of wiring that's associated with the panel?
That's a 3/4 inch of metal conduit. that is gray, and I believe Ruben mentioned it's paintable after inspection.
But is that not needed on this full? Because I don't see it here.
It's on the other side, probably. Or is it?
That's a good question. Mike did the layout for the conduit. I believe it would go on the other side of the dormer. I'm not 100% sure on that, because there's usually a couple different possibilities. There's windows that are there, too.
So we see on the lower picture there in the back of the house, it's running on the sidewall, and then along the bottom of the wall to back to the...
Correct. If you scroll to the second one, you can see if it's changed or not. Yeah. It's the same. Okay. It's on the... What, are you talking about the green conduit line?
Gotcha. Here it shows on the side of the house.
It is the same.
But then up here, you don't...
I'm guessing he chose it because the basement, the lower basement they're having remodeled, there are windows there and everything, maybe just for ease of installation, for code.
It is in a different spot.
Yeah,
so this is further down here?
It looks like it's on the corner.
Can you scroll down just a little more so I can see that?
There.
Meters. Okay, those are the meters.
Here it is.
So this is that conduit?
Mm-hmm.
And then...
I think on the plan there, it shows it in the back corner. Or no, it isn't.
It's in the corner. It's the front corner, I think.
And it punches through the roof?
It does. We have a specific flashing for that, solar specific.
Okay, well...
And everything's black. All the hardware is black. Pretty slick looking.
Are there any more questions in the commission? Does anyone perhaps have a motion?
Would it be appropriate to maybe take the temperature of the commission before we do an official motion?
I don't think we have any rules against temperature taking.
You guys can pull it if you want, or someone could propose a motion and see how the vote goes too. You know, either way.
I'll try a motion.
Oh.
I move that Tacoma Landmarks Preservation Commission approve the solar panel installation at 1220 North 5th following the second proposal with panels in both the front and the back side roof, augmented with two additional panels moved from the rear to the front, in the first line from the street and one in the second line from the street, or band from the street.
Gotcha.
You mean here and here?
Yes. If the first row is one on north facing North M Street, adding one additional to number one and one additional to band number two.
So where the pointer is here and where the pointer is here.
Yes.
Any particular panels you want? Is that for production-wise, can we pick any two we want?
Yeah.
And the lower ones are going to be. Okay. Okay.
And I amended my motion, but the comment being just to take the temperature.
Okay, so there is a motion before the commission. Is there a second to that motion before?
I'll second that. Yeah.
Oh, there's a second by Commissioner Johnson. I have a feeling there may be discussion on the motion.
Well,
there discussion?
It's all right.
I will say the same thing I said before, I guess. I think it's kind of goofy just to have them move a couple of them. If it's going to give them 4% over 25 years, is a lot. I've looked at solar panels, it's a lot. And I just don't think it's good to set precedent now. What's the threshold? 4%, 2%? We don't have any standards. I'm not saying it's like let it slip through the cracks, but it seems pretty negligible, visible impact to just do the first option as opposed to just moving a couple panels and here's another 1%. That's what's going to get in the max. I don't think it's the same as the skylight. I agree. They're removable. It is the future. It's a little bit of a trade-off.
I think that the entry is actually of this house, even though the this roof line is visible from M Street there. The actual entry is on the front side. So this is actually the rear
Correct.
Facing side of the house. I mean, which I'm kind of taking into account as well. I mean, Commissioner Montauk said, you know, having it on the front of your house, I think, does pose kind of a different type of perhaps impact visually than this would, even in the full array. So, I mean, I think I would agree with the commissioner, Sue, that it would be more for the full array first. Is there any?
I would argue that, as the applicant has pointed out, both arrays work well. One array is slightly less efficient. 2%. This is a visible facade. We've always treated corner houses with those facades that are visible from the streets, and corner houses get visible from that, from two streets. So I think that a more conservative approach is more appropriate. If there was a more substantial change in the production, I think that might be something for us to consider. But since there's such a small variance in the production of both locations, the more conservative location in this case is the one that we should choose.
Is there any further discussion?
Can I ask a question?
I don't think technically you can, but
I don't think
can
so.
I don't think you can. There's the motion in no, front of the
okay,
commission.
Never mind. I'll ask you later.
Apologies.
And my only comment is I thought I would just start with the compromise to see where it went.
So
we vote for it.
There's no further discussion. I'll call to a vote. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. Oh, say nay.
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 We have hands.
Yeah, let's do hands. Let's go back and say, all those in favor, raise your hand. Nope, my hand's not raised.
This one is.
That's it. Okay. All those opposed? Abstentions? Okay, so the motion fails. Do we have another motion before the commission?
Can I ask?
Oh, wait. Certainly.
Yes,
you can open up
right,
for questions. Thank you, Commissioner Johnson.
What about reflectivity?
There's an anti-glare coating on the glass.
Anti-glare.
Correct.
So it's not going to be blinding
no,
people
sir.
As they go by?
No.
Because I know low-E glass has a really heat reflection.
Sure. This is a very specific...
Melt
absolutely.
On the house.
It's a very specific tempered glass with a coating on it. So actually, when photons pass the glass to the solar cells, the glass reflects the photons and it bounces back and forth and it harvests more photons on the actual cells. So it sucks in everything it can,
all right.
For lack of a better, more technical term.
It's the first time photons has come before the commission.
Really?
I appreciate the sci-fi nature of this meeting.
Love my job.
Any further questions of the applicant? Do we have a motion?
I move that the Landmarks Preservation Commission approve the application for 1220 North 5th Street, the first option, maximizing solar production.
That's a motion by Commissioner Mortensen. Do we have a second?
Second.
Second by Commissioner Morgenroth. Is there discussion? Hearing none, we'll move to a vote. We'll also vote by hand, either hand, it's your choice. all those in favor, raise your hand. Oh, opposed? Abstentions? The motion carries unanimously.
All right.
Should have been a litigator.
This was, you should feel good that this was,
I feel,
the first vote in
I
a very
love
long time.
My job.
So
I do.
I'd like to suggest that the commission, after they're installed, take a field trip and let's go
great
take
idea.
A look and see what they look like.
Let me know when it is. I'll try to be there.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'd love
great.
To walk you through.
Take that and one up it that we put it on our work list for the coming year to actually address solar panels in our guidelines.
Okay.
Thank you, guys. Thank you very
thank
much.
You.
I appreciate this. This was actually pretty fun.
Thank you for your
I'll talk. Great. Thank you, Marvin. So,
yeah.
Moving on to board briefings. Briefing on detached accessory dwelling units. Did we request this even? Are you just coming?
No, I'm just insisting on briefing you.
Great. Elliot?
Yes. Sure. Hi, everybody. I'm Elliot Barnett from Long Range Planning. Nice to be here tonight. And I have, who likes to have the details? I'll pass these around, and if you don't want one, just pass it on, and we'll repurpose it in another meeting. So I am here to give an update on proposed changes to the accessory dwelling unit code. Some of you have been following and probably pretty aware, and others may not be. So, you know, this is really to your preference in terms of what I focus on, how long I go, how much detail, and all that. So please, you know, feel free to steer me in the right direction. But this is the public comment period for a package of proposed changes to the accessory dwelling unit code before the city council, and the public hearing is on February 19th. So, you know, now's a good time to understand what the proposal contains and, you know, provide comments individually as a commission, however makes sense. And I'll just go through, I'm going to just give an overview of what's in the proposal, the process that got there. There really have been two separate proposals that were developed, and if you track the Planning Commission proposal, it's important to know that the IPS committee took the Planning Commission's recommendations and layered on some additional changes to it. So the proposal that the full council is reviewing is a hybrid of both to some extent, and I can explain what was in the Planning Commission recommendation versus what's in the IPS recommendation, so you understand what's more recent.
So Elliot, can I interrupt you for just a second?
Sure.
I think our questions from our last meeting revolve mostly around conversions of existing garages, for example, into a housing unit, and also in regarding I forget the right terminology, but essentially legalizing existing detached ADUs that may or may not meet the code. And I think the issue for the commission is how to address how we need to perhaps modify our design guidelines and so forth regarding garages and new construction to accommodate the detached ADUs. So it's not quite
not the full breadth of the proposal.
Yeah.
So
okay.
I can speak to that just a bit, because I did ask Elliot to come and provide a briefing on the current status to the commission in the process and what the overall, I guess, outlook for the ADUs is, what the code contains. And I know that there was concern about conversions and existing ones, but there's also regulations, I think, for new ones that are also going to affect what the commission does. And so because Elliot's in mid stride on this with a lot of different touch points with the public process, I wanted the commission to have the opportunity to hear from him at this point to help illuminate the discussion we have that we paused on the design guidelines earlier. So Marshall's absolutely right about that, and so that's what I'm hoping that the commission can gain some insight on is how this works, what actually is in the code going forward. So the both identified concerns and concerns identified things to consider for the design guidelines and things maybe the commission hasn't yet thought of as well will help us with the design guideline alterations or amendments after probably later on the spring, I think, is what we're going to do. So that's kind of the context here.
That's both of those sets of comments very helpful, and that'll help me to focus my comments or my overview, and I'll kind of breeze more quickly past the things that have little to do with design and focus more on the things that have more to do with design guidelines and legalizing existing structures and conversions, things like that. So, And just so you know, well, the dates have been up on the screen, but February 19th, that's the time to comment. And then February 26th, the council at study session is likely to, you know, start talking about any final revisions that they may make. And then first and final reading, March 5th and 19th, and the code would be effective about the beginning of April if it sticks to the schedule. And I'm guessing everybody knows that what an accessory dwelling unit is, second smaller dwelling on the same parcel with a single family house. And you're probably also familiar with the many different policy objectives that are attached to ADUs. Not only a more affordable housing option, but more choice and flexibility for families and households to perhaps take care of a family member, to have companionship, to have income, those sorts of things. And historic pattern that has been around forever, you know, known as granny flats or otherwise. So those and all those objectives have been part of the conversation so far. And the current rules, an attached accessory dwelling unit, meaning that it's, you know, in the basement or an addition on the back of a house or somehow part of the main house, those are already permitted throughout the city. And detached accessory dwelling units, those are the ones that are only currently permitted by special review through the infill pilot program in single-family districts. And that's the big change that these proposals would make, is extending those detached ADUs into the single-family neighborhoods. And this has all been initiated by council resolution. They directed the Planning Commission to put together these proposals to more broadly allow accessory dwelling units in the city. And the outreach themes, some of you may know from having participated, but it's been an interesting discussion because the comments go from really high-minded, you know, big issues like what should a neighborhood contain, what's neighborhood character, what's the right density, things like that. Lots and lots of comments and concerns about affordability, as would not surprise anybody these days. But then down to the really minute things like very specific dimensions and setbacks and heights and things like that. So it's been detailed as well as high level conversation. I would say that generally there's been the comments that we've received have, to oversimplify perhaps, there's a lot of interest. The city has received a lot of comments just saying, yes, in principle at least, ADUs should be more broadly available, but also, you know, a range of different concerns about their impacts and their design and how they might affect the neighboring property, how they might affect parking and traffic and things like that. So the Planning Commission worked on this pretty intensively and in a really expedited process for about 5 or 6 months, as Amy remembers, and met quite a few times and came up with a package of recommendations that you could say, in, you know, long and short of it, they definitely extended where you could do ADUs. First and foremost, detached and single family neighborhoods. But on top of that, they went through the existing standards and looked for chances to make it more flexible, to allow a little bit more size, a little bit more height, to reduce some of the prescriptive standards, basically to try to make it more feasible, I would say, to build more ADUs. And in more locations, they also looked at regulatory processes and had some proposed changes there to make it, again, more easily done. And they also extended that time to legalize existing but unpermitted ADUs, but I'm going to talk a little bit more about that towards the end of the proposal. So the Planning Commission then forwarded that on to the Council. Meanwhile, the IPS, Infrastructure Planning and Sustainability Council Committee, they worked on it, met for a couple of months, and came up with some additional modifications. And they focused, again, on, you know, ADUs should be more broadly available, more flexibility generally. But they removed the requirement, which is currently in, pretty much always been in the code, that the owner reside on the property, that the owner could be either in the main house or in the accessory dwelling unit. But that requirement would be removed. and I'll talk more about their thinking there later in the presentation. They also removed the minimum lot size and dimension standards for an accessory dwelling unit, and I got a slide for that. They did update the ADU design standards, and they did some other clarifications, which I can tell you more about, but relatively minor clarifications on the Planning Commission's proposals. So the main point, you know, there are these two different versions, and track the last packet of changes. You can look in the packet, you can see I've kind of tried to indicate which ones came more recently, so you can know what may be news. And then from here forward, I'm just going to talk about the proposal that's before the council, which is a modified combination of those two proposals. So some common sense, more practical things that the proposal would do is just require that there be visible addressing from the street, density calculations, clarifying that for certain permitting processes, we look at density calculations, and there was a little confusion. Does that apply to ADUs? This essentially just clears that up and how we would review ADUs and for permit processes. Number of occupants, rather than having a set number at 4, which the current code has, this would just point to the building code occupancy standards. Material walkway and width flexibility. The standards currently say 4-foot minimum walkway width. That would go down, again, to a building code standard of 3 feet, and have a little bit more flexibility on the surfacing of the walkway. Clarification, again, that new driveways serving an ADU are not allowed from the front of the parcel, which is also pretty consistent with other residential development. So those are kind of the more practical clarifications or recommendations that the Planning Commission made, that the proposal contains. And then in terms of ADU size and lot size, you know, this has always been something that's confusing to explain to people, and lots of questions all along the process as to, well, how does this work? So I usually dwell on this slide and the next couple of slides a little bit. But the size of the ADU currently has always been proportional to the size of the main house, as well as proportional to the size of the parcel or the or lot. So the ADU size is 15% of the square footage of the lot, or 85% of the square footage of the house, whichever is less. So if you have a small house, then that might be the maximum size, or if you have a small parcel, then that would be the maximum size. What the proposal is doing is, whereas right now, you're just not allowed to build an ADU on a lot that doesn't meet the current zoning standards, which is 5,000 square feet and 50-foot frontage in most of the city zoning district. So if you have a smaller or narrower lot than that, just not going to be able to have an ADU. Well, what this proposal does is it allows those smaller or narrower lots to have an ADU, but the ADU size would just be ratcheted down as the lot gets smaller or the house gets smaller. And then on top of that, the proposal has these maximum sizes of, if you have a small lot, smaller than those 5,000 feet or 50-foot standard dimensions, it just caps the size at 800 square feet. For any standard lot, it's 1,200, and only for particularly large lots, it can go as high as 1,500. And I've got some graphics to illustrate how that works. But before that, council had interest in what we were talking about when we talk about small lots. Essentially, you know, as in many historic districts, as I'm sure you're probably aware, there's lots of different sizes of lots and dimensions of lots that just predate the zoning code, basically. And again, and so this is just a block that I found in one of the neighborhoods of the city. And the yellow lots are considered small lots because they are either slightly more narrow or slightly smaller than the standard lots. In many cases, it's probably pretty tough to pick them out from the street because those differences are usually pretty subtle. Sometimes they, you know, becomes more noticeable, and you can clearly tell that you're looking at a small lot by comparison to the standard size. So again, what this proposal would do is just say, in this hypothetical here, all the yellow parcels could have an accessory dwelling unit. It would just need to be smaller than it would be on the larger larger lots. And so here are a few different examples of how the ADU size could be determined. And you know, so, you know, size is also really very relevant because that's a huge, one of the most significant components of design. So it's definitely, when you're thinking about your design standards and review, it's good to understand how the sizes would be calculated. So just on the far left, you've got a small lot of 2,500 square feet, which is definitely one of our smallest residential lots out there. And in this case, the 1,000 square foot house, the 15% of the lot size would become the maximum at 375 square feet. So
Elliot, is that 375 square feet, is that livable space, or
yes,
is that total space?
It's habitable space.
Habitable space. So if this were on top of a garage, that would be a much larger building.
Indeed.
Overall.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah. And I'll talk a little bit about height as well in a minute here. But then just moving along, you know, in the second example, 5,000 square foot lot, again, it's 15% of the lot size that would control at 750 square feet. At 8,000 square feet, you know, we've created an example here where the size of the house might control 85% of the living space of the house at 1,020 square feet in this example. And then in this very large lot over here, we've got one where the maximum size controls. And even on this large lot of 12,000 square feet, it would just cap out at that 1,500 square foot maximum size. So that's how the ADU size is proposed to work, and that's how it would work on the smaller or narrower lots. As far as height goes, and that kind of gets to Marshall's question about how would that work, the current standards already allow ADUs in most areas at 18 feet. They're not allowed to be any taller than the main house. And 18 feet is measured to the midpoint of the roof line, so the peak could be taller than that. And if, just to kind of picture what that means, you could probably build two stories or one and a half stories at 18 feet to the midpoint of the house. It's a little lower in view-sensitive districts at 15 feet. And a detached ADU has to be in the backyard, has to be 5 feet from the side setbacks. It can be built right on the rear property line. So that, and that's actually how the code works right now. The proposed standards would tweak height and setback rules a little bit, would allow a detached ADU to get to 20 feet, just a couple more feet. And the commission's idea there was to try and make sure that somebody could build an ADU above a garage. They wanted to promote that. So if the ADU has parking below, they could get that extra 2 feet. There's this other option to get that extra 2 feet of a built green certification.
Sorry, quick question. Yeah, so
sure.
In my neighborhood, there's a lot of garages that are built right up to the side property line. So if someone wanted to convert it into an ADU, is that considered a non-conforming structure and they can put it in there? Would they have to have a demising wall at the 5 foot line so the livable space was still, I mean, how would that?
Yeah, that's a good question. So there's a couple different wrinkles on that. And one, during this period when people are essentially being invited to legalize unpermitted ADUs, there's more flexibility. The requirements would be that they have to meet the building code to make the building basically safe. And it has to be in the backyard. But it could actually be permitted close to the side property line. And come in and become a permitted ADU during that time period. Even after that time period, the proposal contains some flexibility for a conversion, but would require a conditional use permit in some cases if it's not going to meet the setbacks and everything.
So you wouldn't need a variance to do that if it was already approached. You would just get the conditional use permit.
Yeah, actually, there's a couple different pathways.
Yeah, I was just curious.
It would either be a variance or
a
conditional use.
Of your garages that seem to be right on all the lines. I was just curious how they would, if someone could do that, or if, how that would work.
Yeah, I actually have a let's see here. We've got, yeah, so this slide actually addresses it. So conversions of existing structures.
Yeah.
Oh no, no, it was a good. It was a perfect time to ask that question, and my answer wasn't quite accurate, because the conversion of an existing structure would be allowed to meet the side yard setback, but you would have to meet the building code, and you might well have to put that firewall in.
Right. Sure.
And then conversions can exceed height with that conditional use permit. So more flexibility to do. This code is more open to conversions than the previous code would be. I see a question.
Well, it kind of threw me to say DADUs must be in the rear yard. Is there any essence when something could be built in the front yard?
You know, pretty rare. You can't build, you're not allowed to build any accessory structure in the front yard. Mm-hmm. But in certain cases, if you happen to have a lot where, you know, the house was set way back, you could apply for a variance, and it's possible that you could get.
Could you build a structure in the front yard and change the definition so the rear building would be the accessory unit?
Yeah, you could do that. So let's say you had a building in the back that met the definition of an ADU and met kind of the size and setback rules. You could essentially convert that to an ADU and build a main house in front of it. That's possible.
Thanks.
Sure. And then ADU design standards. There are already design standards in the code. They kind of got clarified and made a little bit more specific here. One is just that a rather general, more of a policy objective statement than anything, that the ADU should complement the main house. Another, that if the ADU is located in an historic district, that it needs to meet all the rules and standards and review process for the historic district. And then commits my department to develop an illustrative guide to what all this means and what does complement actually look like, at least in a few different examples of hypotheticals.
What is the review process for complementing the main house? Is that a staff review or a commission review?
That it's purely a staff review, except in historic districts.
Right.
Yeah, and that's the tension here. We have an urban design program that's getting initiated and studied and analyzed right now. So that may change in the next couple of years, but for the moment, it's current planners reviewing it. And then, so relatively minimal design standards for smaller and attached ADUs, but for larger detached ones, the code has a couple of additional standards that would require that the main entrance, if it faces the neighbor, that has to be set back a little bit further, just to kind of keep the activity a little further from the neighboring property. If the structure is tall and close to that side property line with another neighboring property, then the second story windows have to be designed to promote privacy, and the roof has to be designed to reduce shading impacts. So the intent of all these design standards was, you know, relatively light touch, relatively easy to implement at the staff administrative level, but deal with what might be the biggest impacts of a very large ADU that's close to a neighboring property. So that was the idea.
So in the right-hand example, above a garage, you're measuring the height halfway up the roof line? Is that how I remember you saying that?
That's true, in terms of determining how tall the detached ADU can be.
Yeah. So if they configure the roof correctly, it could be really tall, but still meet the guidelines.
Yes, I know. We've wondered about that. I mean, you could sort of have a wizard's hat type of a design.
But then it's taller than the main structure overall, right. So at least you get that.
That's right.
Yeah, okay. That's true, too. But, yeah, I mean, it is true that I've always wondered about that, but that's how the building code works, and so far I haven't seen that example.
When you say taller than the main structure, does that mean the overall height or
the mid-roof height?
Yeah, the mid-roof height.
Oh, it's not the overall height? It could be, the overall height could be taller if you figure out how to finagle the
Let answer the question.
You know, you're the first ones to ask me this question. But I'm pretty sure what we would do is, you know, we have a methodology to determine the height, and that's measured to the midpoint. So we would take that measurement for the main house and then the measurement for the ADU. So in theory, I guess you could have a very tall, narrow roof that would be taller than the tallest point of the main house.
Except it might not match, be compatible to the main house if the roof line is dramatically different, I guess would be the complementary catch on the other side.
Yeah. I'm trying to think if there's anything else that would prevent that from happening. I'll bring that question back to my current planning.
You need these very strange A-frame, two-story A-frame kind of.
Right. Lines. Could happen. So, I think this is my last slide or my last substantive one. So, in terms of establishing that time frame to legalize non-conforming ADUs, the idea here is that it would be an improvement to take an unpermitted ADU and at least get it, you know, generally complying with the building code and at least located in the rear yard. And so this is something that had been in the code before. It had expired years ago. So this proposal just put the new date on it of December 2020. So people have a year to kind of come in and in exchange, they get some additional flexibility in terms of the setbacks and the height of the structure. So they could come in and without getting a variance or a CUP, they could legalize an existing unpermitted ADU. So that's kind of the trade-off. And then the owner occupancy change. What that does is, again, removes the requirement that the owner live on the site. The property would still need to be owned together, so you couldn't have two separate owners, but you could have two separate renters and the owner living off-site. And also, the current code requires the property owner to go record a notice on title that there's an ADU on the site. So the proposal removes that requirement as well, because most of what that notice on title said was that the owner was going to live on the site. And so the removal of that requirement came with the removal of the ownership requirement. And there are a few other minor tweaks that staff are going to develop to kind of implement that change. Such as one example being right now you can have short-term rental in the rental unit of an ADU or the main house, whichever is the rental unit. So it's sort of been, it's a new question, can you have two short-term rentals if you have two rental units? So there are a few follow-on questions that staff's still working on to bring back to council. And probably.
Elliot, isn't it currently in the code that short-term rentals require owner occupancy?
Well, good question. Yeah,
it does.
You may know this.
Today.
There you go.
You mean short-term,
so,
you're talking like Airbnb type of situation.
Right.
And that was recently done to because of the problem that long-term rentals and houses for sale were being taken off the market to be used as short-term rentals, and so that does not help the affordability issue at all.
So it may not be a significant issue. There's just still a few scenarios that we're working through at the staff level to figure out if there are any other. Another one is the ADU allows you to have a small home business called a home occupation in each of the two units, but only one can receive customers on the premises. So should that be revisited? They're relatively minor additional tweaks that we might bring forward for the council to consider.
I have a question about the current standards as far as are ADUs restricted to be just one unit, or could potentially 1,500 square foot unit be two separate units, or is there a restriction?
It's only allowed to be one additional unit.
So, thinking of affordability and owner-occupied, if an investor or developer decides to buy a house and put in a DADU in the backyard but not live there, could it be required that one of those two be low-income housing with a cap on the rents?
I don't know how you would determine that, but it sure would help with affordability rather than just milking the public for everything they can get.
Yeah, that's a great question. And the proposal as it stands doesn't have any specific affordability requirements as part of this. The idea being that you're creating a smaller, you know, relatively small, probably relatively affordable unit in a neighborhood. So we often say like small A affordability just through more housing options in a neighborhood. But there have been conversations, and council's been, you know, at study session earlier this week, they were asking that question. And the city does have standards that could be applied, you know, in exchange for bonuses of one kind or another. The city could say you can have those bonuses if you enter this property into a program and it's affordable for a set period of time at set costs. And so that may be discussed further by council moving forward.
So has the city weighed in on the state legislative proposals that have been introduced this year on this issue?
Great question. And no, we have not. They came.
So they're significantly different than what we're seeing here.
Preempt everything that's planned.
Yes.
Yeah. No. Short answer is no. And that came to my attention relatively recently, and I think it's more sweeping than what we're proposing here. So if that passes, we'll be coming back with some additional changes.
Does anyone have any more questions?
So let's see if we can talk. Well, I don't know. Do we want to talk about the specific issues that we were talking about at our last meeting about conversions and so forth, or do we want to wait for that?
I think that if there's anything that Commission thinks Ellie might add or be able to answer that would inform that conversation, you know, he's here now. But as far as the actual design guidelines and things that we want to talk about putting in those, I think that's a later discussion. Just, I know that we have another agenda item, so
I'll ask one question. And
yeah.
Anybody else can. But so one of the things that we were puzzling over at our last meeting was basically a garage that exists now, and someone deciding that they're going to convert that garage, not rebuild it into like a second story or anything like that, but just take the garage, single story garage, and convert it into a housing unit. So our puzzle was, I think, this, that our design guidelines on garages have been quite flexible. They're small, they're in the back, you know, and so forth. And so things about windows and so forth and so on that we might apply to a larger building or the main house don't apply to the garage. And so one of our questions, I think, was, well, do we create kind of a moral hazard, as it were, because somebody could come in and build a garage and get that approved, and with vinyl windows and so forth and so on, and then come in and want to convert that to detached ADU. And then we were thinking about, well, if we have design guidelines that are specific to detached ADUs, then how does that work with the conversion and so forth? And I would just have you in the planning department really thought very much about that scenario at all?
Not in the context of the historic districts. It's interesting because the planning commission really wanted to relax the design standards. Their proposal really dialed back existing design standards quite a bit, and the council committee added some back. And so I would say that it's unclear whether, you know, there's not, you know, general agreement on what the policy should be for an accessory structure located in the backyard, whether it's a garage or an ADU. Their opinions differ on that, and it's still an open question even where council's going to land on those standards. So we don't the current code as it sits, or the proposal as it sits, would lean on whatever triggers would already apply for historic district review. And so if in the scenario that you laid out with a conversion, I don't know actually whether that would come before you and require historic review or not. You know, it may depend on the degree of exterior changes that are occurring.
Probably not for an existing, for a new modern garage that had been constructed within, you know, the past year, you know, and then somebody wanted to alter it, and then it probably wouldn't trigger review with the commission. I have a question, though, maybe just I think I know the answer, but so if a homeowner wants to build a garage as a parking structure versus building a DADU, there's more flexibility in the DADU construction than there is in the construction of a parking structure. I mean, you can get more building volume onto a lot if it's a DADU permitted versus if it's a car, garage, parking structure. Is that correct?
Well, you mean in terms of there's a 2 foot height bonus at least that would let you make it a little bit taller. Mm-hmm. But I don't
know. I'm not talking about a conversion. I'm just talking about if I was going to build a new building.
Yeah.
If I'm going to build a DADU, construct one, or if I'm going to build a new garage to park my car in.
So if the question is, which is one allowed to be larger than the other?
Yes.
I don't think so, because the they're both controlled by, they're both technically accessory structures still. And a garage is controlled by its building footprint, and this is really the way it gets really hard to explain this. But it's controlled by its building footprint, and those numbers are the same as the maximum sizes that now are in the ADU section. So I think they end up being the same size, you know, except for that 2 foot extra height bonus that ADUs get if they include parking.
Okay, so same home, more or less, with a bonus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Yeah.
Nice to talk to you.
So it sounds like we're going to have food to do.
Yes.
with the guidelines.
Yeah, future.
And I wish I could stay.
Oh, yes.
Yes. So we have our second board briefing of the evening.
So exciting.
Tacoma Crew, Amy and Brad. The deferrals, multiple motions, briefings. You don't have a ferry to catch.
That's true.
Everybody, my name is Amy McBride. I'm the arts administrator for the city of Tacoma, and my Office of Arts and Cultural Vitality, is charged with implementing this fantastic Tacoma Creates program that was passed by the voters of Tacoma by 67% or something in November. So what I'm hoping to do this evening is explain to you what we know, what we don't know, and all of the work that we have to do to make sure that this is really the game changer that it can be for our community. And to also be very clear that it's arts, culture, heritage, and science. And this year is really a ramp-up year, so we're working to make sure that we're talking to everybody. And while the Arts Coalition of Pierce County is the organization that's really pushed the campaign and put the elbow grease behind developing sort of the rudimentary structure for this, now that it's actually passed, we have a lot of work to do. So the people on the Arts and Culture Coalition that represent the heritage community are the Historical Society, the State History Museum's been involved, Job Carp has been involved, Buffalo Soldiers Museum. But I'm looking to you to find out who else should we be talking to. We're looking to do some specific focus groups to make sure that whatever the needs are of the heritage community, including definitions of things or whatever hasn't been thought about is thought about. Okay, so that's part of what I'm gonna be asking you today. So we gave a a presentation on the 23rd of January to the community. There are about 300 folks there, which is basically this presentation I'm going to give you. And that's a lot of what we're going to be doing is getting out in the community more and talking to folks. But let's see. I wanted you to be clear that the tax doesn't even start to be collected till April 1st, so businesses won't even see it until then. And then the money won't be collected and accumulated in the city treasury till June 1st. So the amount of money being collected will be that much less than it will be in future years. They're projecting about $5 to $6 million a year of funding that will be flowing into arts, culture, heritage, and science. So it is, it's a game changer for our community. And that's why I said it's a ramp up year. The originating legislation really sets the parameters for what Tacoma Creates or what Tacoma Creates will become, in that it is supposed to increase access to arts, culture, heritage, and science activities, and reduce barriers, and increase equity for who's participating, how people are participating, how they get there. Transportation is a big piece of this. So it's really this complex system that we have to figure out. And I kind of like to look at it on two things. So at the end of the day, when the funding's flowing, there's the service provider side. So people that are producing programs and projects, be they in an institution or independent of an institution, have to be able to create free or reduced programs, improve the access to their facilities, all those things on the left. And then the other thing that we're trying to figure out in advance of that is the systemic support. How does this happen? How do we make sure, what does the accountability look like? What are we evaluating? What do we want people to be accomplishing? And that's kind of this first year of talking to folks, is like, what does Tacoma look like differently in 2025 when this happens? And then, you know, what does it feel like differently in your neighborhood if these things are going on all of a sudden or for a number of years, and your kids have a place to go after school and they're learning all kinds of neat stuff. And I'm going to go through these a little bit more specifically. So like I said, we're going to be having these community conversations. We need to have focus groups and technical working groups around which heritage will be one topic. So how many of those we need to have and the like, we need to figure that out. So I think arts, of course, has been the lead, so there's a lot more figured out in that area. Heritage has been at the table, but not enough. Culture and science probably the least, but even interesting, the crossover of culture and heritage and arts, and what does that look like in our community, and what are these definitions that we need to be deciding. There will be an advisory board that is unique to any of the ones we've had, so that is very important, and there will be representation on there from every content expert area, so an arts person, a heritage person, science. Culture, we're looking at probably an education person, and then looking at making sure that somebody from every neighborhood is represented as well, but that's even setting up that advisory structure is something that we're looking for input on. The other thing that I'm thinking about, and I just want to throw this out there, is whether it makes sense for us to have liaisons from our commissions, like Arts and the Immigrant Refugee Commission and Landmarks, to somehow intersect with this advisory board. I just want to make sure that there's a integration of the existing work that's happening as we add a new advisory board to the mix. That advisory board will be responsible for reviewing and approving the guidelines and the funding that will be put to the streets. We are proposing, the way that we do our current funding programs with the Arts Commission, that a unique selection panel is put together for each review, so that it's always a mix of folks and that it's not just the same people always making these decisions. So these are a lot of ways that you all or people that you know can plug into this process in the future, just so you're aware of that. Trying to figure out the budget and staffing and consulting, of course. And this baseline data and measurement goals is key. You know, and I'd like you to think about if there are things that you're hoping for in your field that you'd like to see improved. There is a question about one of the things that's an allowable cost is our capital improvements. That hasn't been something that we've addressed, but I have received questions about whether that would be allowed. So even though that amount of money sounds like a lot, when it gets to capital stuff, it isn't really that much. So really looking at that and seeing when and how that might be useful or not. The other thing that I wanted to just mention is that this funding cannot supplant existing funding that is currently being committed to the work you're doing. So Ruben and I had an initial conversation around the funding that you all redistribute currently. There might be an opportunity for you to redeploy that funding as long as it stays within the lane of what you need to do and what the goals of the city are and the Preservation Commission. We haven't figured that all out yet, but nobody gets to say, oh, you don't get that money now because this money is happening over here. A lot of what we're going to be doing this year as well and throughout the course of the program is training and capacity building. So who's out there? What do they need to know? How do we help shore up our organizations? What are the biggest issues that people currently face? Do they just need to be able to hire somebody finally, or do those things that keep organizations, particularly the smaller ones, kind of always running on fumes and kind of not quite making it there? It's certainly my hope, I'm not the only one, that this funding can help shore up some of those organizations and help them to do this work. It is not our intention to be coming in and asking people to be working in the schools and doing all these other things without making sure that they're solid and able to take on this extra work. So for the funding models, what that means is that this year we're looking to deploy the funding to service providers in some capacity, probably more tied around that capacity building and kind of getting baseline information figured out, because we don't have all the money yet this year and we're not ready to be able to do a full-blown funding program right now anyway. So using this year to really figure out all these basic things, but also be able to start to flow the money into the community. Transportation is a specific expectation of this program. The city's resolution identifies up to 8% of the funding go toward transportation. So that is key. What does that mean? Getting kids to institutions, from their schools to places. That's been an age-old problem of schools not being able to have enough money to get the kids to go places. But we're looking again at that much more systemically. Is it just yellow buses, or is there a way to work with ORCA passes and things like that, which I'll talk about in a second? Communications, of course, our partnerships, and then figuring out this whole system delivery, which I'm going to get into a little bit more right now. One of the requirements is that we have a public school access program, and the originating legislation identifies that we need to be committing a certain percentage of funding towards public schools. That percentage has not been decided yet. However, the city's resolution requires that 52% of these resources go into the neighborhoods. So there will definitely be some kind of crossover. Schools are all in every neighborhood, so they're a great place to be doing this. And we're looking to leverage whatever initiatives and funding is happening currently, because we need to be able to do all these things in the schools. And we're looking at the extended learning time, so the before, after school, and during the summer. That's what the school district prefers. It won't preclude the ability to go into the classroom, but their preference is to be working in this out-of-school time, to provide safe places for kids, making sure that there's food there, and then this transportation piece. Now, there are several initiatives going on already. I don't know if you're familiar with the Wallace Grant that the Greater Tacoma Community Foundation is piloting this year. It's in 12 different schools, and it's focused on social-emotional learning. And they are providing different programs before, after school, and all this stuff. But the service providers aren't being paid. So Tacoma Creates will be able to pay service providers to flow into this school space and to be able to serve kids in a way that's already been vetted and developed, and they have some wonderful tools for tracking students' progress and the demographics of the kids and the socioeconomic levels of families, because there is a goal to prioritize areas that are underserved. One thing we're looking to do is to build on the whole child access pass. I don't know, or is anybody familiar with this? It's piloted now, but it's kind of really it's just getting started, so it's not as evolved as it will be. But it's the bones for doing all of these things here. So what the whole school access pass would be, one tool for kids and their families to be able to not only access services, athletics, and whatever projects and programs Tacoma Creates is doing. It will also act as a bus pass, a library card. It will have the students' socioeconomic data on there, so they won't have to fill out a million different papers, and it'll be the same pass that if I'm paying full price and you're getting in free. So it kind of it takes away the stigma of some of the free and reduced lunch thing, and all that. So I'm really excited about making this a robust tool as part of Tacoma Creates. I think this will be the real systemic game changer for our community. And then, yes?
Is there a buy-off with the school districts to get that access to that data for the providers?
Yes. Well, they currently, in their relationship with the Wallace Grant and with Metro Parks, they are sharing some of that data already. So that's the other good news, is that a lot of that work and those relationships and access to that data has, a lot of the bumps have been worked out, so we won't have to start that from scratch. So how much people get to see and stuff, I'm not sure. But it's really promising. What we know is that if you want to apply for this funding, you do need to be a 501c3 nonprofit. That's in the originating legislation. However, you can be fiscally sponsored, and we're figuring out the ins and outs of how that can work. Because one, I don't want a million 501c3s out there. It's not the greatest idea in the world. And we really want this money to be going to the smaller programs and projects that have been just, doing amazing things already in community, that, shouldn't have to go and become a nonprofit to access this funding. And if you are a program or project more than a major arts organization, a culture, heritage, science organization, then we just need to be able to, we're recommending that people have at least 2 years of programming, some kind of track record. But then we're also looking at this as an ecosystem approach, at least with the arts organizations. The Arts Commission is looking at then how do we support more emerging programs, projects, organizations that aren't ready to do this yet. So looking at it comprehensively as possible. One thing that is pretty solid, because I think it was even in the resolution, if you're an organization that is of the stature where 15% of your budget would be an amount worth having, as opposed to if you have a budget of $10, 15% isn't really going to do much. What we propose is that they need to be able to do all these things in order to qualify for up to 15% of their budget with a max of $400,000. So these would be your Tacoma Arts Live, Tacoma Art Museum, Museum of Glass, the big guys. And they need to do all these things in order to qualify for that money. And with that said, we need to figure all these ins and outs of what that exactly looks like still. But generally, that's what they would do. And then programs and projects can do one of those three things, or several of them if they choose, as long as the access, DEI, collaboration, capacity, and all those things are part of the mix. So they're willing to participate in all the things that are required on the bottom. But somebody may just want to work in schools and do nothing, that's the space they want to work in. Some people, maybe they've run that amazing festival in their community for years, and that's the piece that they want to come in at. So it's meant to be flexible. We need to figure out what these guidelines look like and what exactly people need and want and what fits in with the way the legislation's structured. We have a fair amount of flexibility locally, but these are the things that we know that we have to hit. And then there might be emerging funding opportunities. So those two that I shared is what we figured out to date is kind of like buckets that we could work around, but there might be other things that haven't come up yet because we haven't talked to everybody yet, and we want to. That's what I know so far. So I don't know if that helps you understand it a little bit better, or but I'm happy to answer questions and you know, receive whatever feedback you have around concerns, questions, ideas.
I would be curious. You mentioned heritage being at the table sometimes, but not enough. Mm-hmm. And I'd be curious, you know, how would one join the table in a more frequent fashion? Is full disclosure, I'm also on the board of Historic Tacoma,
okay.
which is another 501c3 that I know would be very interested in participating and getting more information and being part of those conversations for the heritage piece at least.
Okay. I'm trying to think if they're at those meetings. But yeah, Historic Tacoma, okay.
So, I mean, I'm also happy to email you offline, but mm-hmm. Just getting a sense of, are you looking for, like, names, of just a list of names, list of people, to try to get out into the community? Is that what you're...
I'm looking to do a focus group to start with of some kind, and I don't even necessarily want to use that word because sometimes that means it's limited in number of people, but
mm-hmm.
some sort of technical working group,
mm-hmm.
something that is getting the people around the table that want to be at the table,
mm-hmm.
And even helping decide whether it needs to be a bigger group or a smaller one or whatever. You know, I don't intend for it to be onerous, but I think there's some key discussions that need to happen initially. So, yeah, if you want to tell me names or organizations, if you have a list of who's out there that you could share with us, then we hope to be doing those kind of meetings, you know, in the next month.
Okay.
So to get that ball rolling.
We must have some kind of a heritage organization.
The master list.
In your office, right? Yeah, I can name a bunch.
I was going to say, it's probably a short list, right?
and I would hope that most of them are already aware of this.
I would just want to point out what Jennifer said there about Historic Tacoma. Sometimes people get confused. The Historic Tacoma is a different organization from the Tacoma Historical Society.
Right.
So just make sure that...
Right. As you said that, I was like, okay.
Yeah.
I got the tigers.
Have you been talking with the ethnic historical associations like Slovenian American Society and Pacific Center and...
Asia Pacific Cultural Center's definitely been at they're a main member of the Arts Coalition, so they've been at the table, Central Latino. But no, I think some of those, probably Slovenian Hall and Normana Hall, not so much. So those are really good suggestions. Yeah, and I think that space of, you know, how we're defining culture and how we're defining heritage is really important,
mm-hmm.
too. People have different perceptions of what those things mean sometimes. I like to err on inclusive of as many people as possible, which I don't know if everyone agrees with me. But
when I lived in Olympia and was on the commission there, they had a really robust program of historic interpretive signings that included ethnic history and... would that be something that would be possible? Would an organization come to you and say, I want to interpret the fact there was a Japanese-American community that no longer
mm-hmm.
exists? Would that come through a 501c or this commission saying, we would like to put up 10 markers around Tacoma about whatever? I just really liked it because it was very permanent and
mm-hmm.
very well done. So.
That's exactly the kind of... somebody... would have to be a 501 or a 501 umbrellaed organization to propose that project, but I don't see why that kind of project wouldn't be perfectly within this opportunity. But that's where having these discussions where we make sure that kind of thing gets to be allowed, you know. So if it becomes, oh no, it's only just programs in schools, which I'm not saying it is, but that's
right.
a big chunk of it. I think it's important for us to be able to clarify the types of things that count. You know, I think it fits well within what we're talking about, but that's a really good example of of being clear about what a public benefit might look like and the different ways it might manifest for heritage and historic organizations.
That also could even be public art. Could it be like wayfinding signs for historic cultural sites?
Possibly. It's not determined yet, so we get to figure that. That's what we're saying. We get to, and that's the thing. Like, what are the other? Yeah, what are these kind of things? What does this fit? Does that fit? Does that,
We're talking about increasing access and helping people identify where those places are.
For sure. I think it sounds great, but yeah, having those conversations and being clear about what sort of. What would apply? What would fit in within this or not? Makes sense to me. But.
So is there connectivity then between your office and say the Office of Historic Preservation? I mean, are those? I'm just kind of thinking. Kind of big picture. Your efforts really have been on underserved communities. Like when we've seen the projects that have come across here from UW.
Right.
There are those communities out there that, in terms of heritage. I think have been not as recognized.
Well,
how those efforts might kind of fit in with.
I think there's some over. Well, so I guess a couple of different things. I mean, when Amy mentioned, existing programs that we have, and whether or not, like for instance, our Heritage Project grant, there's a lot of overlap between what this could do and what we're currently doing. Every other year with our Heritage Project grant program, it's not capital funding that we provide. This is programming. Education, documentation, those sorts of things. But this might be something and there's that focus, definitely. And then there's also the stuff that we have done with other neighborhoods, more geographical diversity within the city. I think there's similar, there's no formal role for the Tacoma Historic Preservation Office in Tacoma Creates at all, at least presently. And so, but what I hope to have is some coordination between what we're trying to do and that we're not doing the exact same thing, but at the same time not decreasing the level of service that's provided overall to the community. So, I think getting back to the point of Ken asked about the Luka Heritage Commission, is that right? I said that right? About a marker wayfinding program or something like that. This, as I understand, Tacoma Creates is not going to provide any. Programmatic funding back to the Historic Preservation Office or the Landmarks Commission. So the Landmarks Commission is going to continue to operate under the budget we have. So, other community partners who wanted to do work like a marker program, or if we decided we wanted to do one ourselves, we could in partnership or in some other way. But does that answer the question?
Yeah, I think it's with that collaborative aspect, I guess, is what I had in mind. Because as you're talking here, you're talking about all these things that I think we've been talking about, with diversity in the neighborhoods and this kind of requirement, it sounds like, to make sure all neighborhoods are represented, that there's a lot of kind of overlap in efforts in reaching out. If you're reaching out to every neighborhood and talking about issues of heritage, having that kind of unified presence out there would be a good thing, it would seem.
Absolutely, and that's what this is starting to say, and also looking even at the city's overall strategic vision and making sure that this is an opportunity to keep moving us all towards the better ends that we're all trying to accomplish. So I'm hoping that this focus group, of course, Ruben's office will be dragged forced into it. Because I want to understand what is it that you all are working on? What are the gaps? How can this help advance what we're all trying to do here? And where does it make sense for the Tacoma Creates piece? Even though it's not supposed to supplant, can it loosen up you to do something else with the money that you currently give to projects or not? There might be a legal restriction to that. We don't know yet, but we need to investigate all those things, figure it all out.
Yeah, that's all I had in mind. Kind of working together, it seems like there's a lot of the same goals.
Yes.
That those offices are doing. So
absolutely.
Doing them together would probably.
Absolutely.
So
combining
yeah.
forces instead of having competing programs.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And stretch your dollar and effort a lot longer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And being able to leverage the resources. That's what. And I'm all about the ecosystem approach? Like, what, how do we, you know, not, I think that's the whole concept of the supplanting. It's not to replace things that are happening so they don't continue to, so the same things just keep happening. If it can, now I started a train of thought that I don't, is derailing in my own brain, but if this helps to accomplish some of the things that we're all hoping to do, but okay, that's kind of taken care of now, we can focus our efforts on A, B, and C that we still have on our plate that we want to really make sure happen for the city. I don't know if I made that point clear.
And one of the things that I was thinking that's come up before us in our discussions that we don't really have a lot of say in or purview, you know, as of yet, although it's kind of just like intangible heritage. I know we've talked about that. I mean, this seems like an avenue that would be ripe for that.
What was that word?
Intangible heritage.
Intangible heritage. See? Tell me more.
Yeah, so
I'll add Commissioner Marks.
Well, we had a discussion about some guidelines updating, and I brought up the idea of having a criterion in the landmarks guidelines, which would include intangible heritage or things that maybe were meaningful to the community for reasons other than the physical structure.
Mm.
So a lot of the things that we deal with on this commission are, you know, architectural significance, historical significance, but there's also this piece of a structure having the capacity to convey its significance, and so that comes along with sort of being physically intact, having physical integrity.
Mm.
But there is a fairly strong and maybe growing movement in the preservation world to incorporate intangible heritage into preservation and considerations for landmarks and different things like that.
Mm.
So, you know, if a building has been really significant to a community, but it's been significantly altered,
mm-hmm.
is it not, you know, should that be still considered for landmark status due to its significance to the community? And then, if it is, the answer to that question is yes, how does a board like ours, or perhaps another city entity, manage that? If there's no specific guidelines for, you know, well, this is a certain architectural style, so we preserve these things,
mm-hmm.
and those are the rules. So it just comes with a lot of very gray areas, but
mm-hmm.
it is something that the preservation world, I think, is trying to tackle.
Interesting.
Which would also include, you know, things like landscapes or perhaps, you know, there's also sort of cultural traditions and other types
mm-hmm.
of things that maybe wouldn't be the purview of this
right,
commission,
but
a lot of those topics are being discussed.
Yeah.
In preservation. So.
Great. Yeah, stuff like that. Because if that can be defined or somehow within, you know, because this is the ground we're starting, this is the ground up, with the intent that those are things that we want to be able to see or help people to know that that qualifies for.
Yeah.
Support and things like that.
Well, there's some really great existing language that the National Park Service has a program called Traditional Cultural Properties, which I don't understand very well, and I think
it's also federal law.
Yes, yeah. So in Washington State, as I understand, the only TCPs we have are tribally affiliated,
mm-hmm.
but there are some other states that have, you know, different traditional cultural properties related to other histories. But the language in the traditional cultural properties program is actually pretty interesting, and I would be happy to forward it to you
mm-hmm.
and continue the discussion.
Okay.
I think that, and the UNESCO, I think, language even takes it kind of
mm-hmm.
that step further beyond, you know, TCPs still have a thingness about them, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
It's that kind of defining there's something there.
Yeah.
And the UNESCO intangibles, really, there's not a necessarily a thingness, you know. It might be songs, it might be stories, it might be certain cooking, you know. I mean,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
certain recipes or certain things you're making, you know. I mean, all those kind of things that are somehow integral to who you are as a culture. That without,
nice.
If you didn't continue those, you would lose something
right.
of that culture. Of that.
I love it. That's great. Yeah, I think this space is perfect to advance some of those things.
Much more than our commission.
You know, we have different...
Cheese making.
We have some
windows.
Beer drinking.
It's high on our cultural.
And to be able to have the that discussion of the vision, like if Tacoma looks like XYZ in 2025 and it includes that, and then we work back. So how do we get to those places? What are the types of things just like you're describing that we want to be sure to be considering? It's really exciting. And I look forward to working with you all more. So I will be in touch with Ruben about, well, feel free to email me directly mm-hmm. if you need, you know, want to shoot me anything. But we'll be looking to schedule some couple-hour summit, some sort of heritage, mm-hmm. something, you know. And if there are, you know, things, topics or consideration that you think would be important to be tackling, let me know. I mean, I'm open to getting to the best end.
Great. Thank you.
Really good to see you
appreciate
all.
Appreciate it.
I need waiting so long.
Yeah. Oh, time.
It's cool. We only have one more item
yes.
on our agenda, which is one of my favorites, our Historic Preservation Month Awards.
Awards!
So, and the theme. I don't know the theme. Everyone else probably knew the theme on the last show.
I can't leave without knowing the theme.
Well, Preservation
didn't
Month
the survey?
Theme.
What is it?
No, well, that's NAPC.
That was,
oh,
yeah, that was
okay.
For the conference.
Sorry.
Oh, yeah.
So, Commission, this is Deirdre Patterson. She's been sitting here patiently quite the evening. She's our intern working on our Preservation Month and other programming activities. And Lauren and her have been coordinating. Lauren's on family leave, as you all know, but she's not relaxing or anything like that. She's got
way
more.
I get
more.
So many emails from her. I'm like,
yeah. Yeah. Lauren likes to stay busy too. But anyways, so what we have here is actually it's really the meeting on February 27th. We have to do this, which is decide on the categories for the Historic Preservation Month Awards. But we wanted to introduce the discussion now, because we have a habit of pushing things, and there's a schedule that we have to keep to get our press release out and to get solicit our nominations, because now the commission, as opposed to the way it used to be done, where we identified things we wanted to reward or award, that the commission identifies the categories and then solicits nominations from the community, which I think is more fun too. And so, Deirdre and Lauren prepared a list of categories from past years, and also in the ensuing pages we have a few years of the recipients that we've had in the past too. And so really the discussion right that we need to have is really the selection of the categories at this point, and it can be done tonight, it can be done at 27th, maybe we have time for that, right?
Mm-hmm.
We can push it back. Yeah, right, let's just push it back. And so we do have a recommended set that is basically a fairly straightforward set of categories that are based on previous years. But also, you know, the discussion that I'm hearing, just even the Tacoma Creates discussion now about intangible heritage and those sorts of things, that maybe there are additional categories that the commission should want to consider. Now, of course, this is a discretionary process by the commission, so if these categories are identified and then nominations come in that either don't quite fit those categories or that there's other categories that might sound better or work better, the commission has always reserved the right to make those decisions at the time of deciding on the awards.
It's a little like the scoring in Whose Line Is It Anyway?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, where there's just a point assigned by the announcer, right? Yeah. So at any rate, is there anything you wanted to add, or did I miss anything?
No.
Okay. And our theme, it is Broadening Horizons this year, is that the Reservation Month theme. So we actually created an awards category in the prior years just for that, Broadening Horizons of Preservation, which really was for projects or programs that explored underdocumented or under served or appreciated aspects of history, local history, and that was to the Tacoma Historical Society, and I think that's an increasingly important theme. It's always been important, but I think there's an increasing awareness of it too. And I think that's an important component of whatever we do with the preservation awards. So having said that, I can take advisement. We can decide later or have a discussion.
Well, you have do you have people? Everyone sees the recommended categories there.
I have a question just for the difference between leadership and preservation and organization and preservation. Is that the difference between an individual and an organization, or is leadership more intended for like a political or an elected official?
Yes.
Yes and yes. Okay.
All of this, yes.
Okay.
I mean, really, if you look in the past recipients, it's varied.
Okay.
Leadership has been an individual who has done a lot for preservation. It has organizations have been, just whatever activity, how it benefits preservation or awareness of history is really the key. We've had initiatives, policy initiatives and things like that that have also fallen under this. So it's really flexible. And if the commission wants to further define it to guide their nomination process, then we can do that too and put out the press materials.
And the press materials do contain kind of a sentence of description for each category.
Yeah, very brief though. Okay. And if there's additional guides we want to put on, that we could.
Okay.
We've had a couple of interesting naming, that kind of tangential job we have of reviewing naming proposals. Some of them, I guess, are really this year, not last year, but the Judge Tannen Park and the Fishing Wars Bridge are ethnic. And, would they, they're not really preserving something, but they're bringing a part of our heritage to broader public attention. I'm just wondering if one of those fit, if they fit in one of these categories. I kind of forget that we do that job until it got really interesting.
Well, yeah. Well, and it's going to get increasingly interesting, let me tell you. So, but I'd say that, I mean, the examples you give are really definitely, I think, under that broadening perspective, scope. But, I would say from my own personal policy perspective on this, I wouldn't want to have a category that exclusively focused on the naming process itself. But I think that if for instance somebody wanted to nominate the Parks Commission, for instance, for the Judge Jack Tanner Park naming request, that would absolutely be something that would fit under that category, I think. But it's up to you guys to really make that determination. But I would say that's the fitting.
That making it fit seems much better than having a category.
Yeah. I think there are multiple categories it could fit under, depending on which naming. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe doing a little bit of work in the community to talk to people about that could, and just giving awards out for that type of action might help raise awareness of that as a one of the things that we do.
And I just comment that I really love the Heritage Legacy Business one that we, was last year the first year that we did that?
That been prior to that.
Yeah. And now we've got second use in addition to her
prize.
We have a list of all going back to 2007, I think 2001 or 2002. But we the legacy business one is something that came much later.
I think that's the only one.
Maybe it was just last year.
Maybe she had a list of ones for us to keep about.
It was discussed. It's been discussed before.
Crystal Freeze.
So I think the big question to consider right now is there anything in this list that's missing, that's obviously missing? And if not, you can always shoot me emails to things you think of, and then we'll bring it back as a sort of a draft final list for next meeting.
Yeah, overall, I think the list looks good. It's pretty solid.
All right.
Yeah. So that's the Any commissioners have categories that come into their heads and want to send those to Ruben?
Yes, yes.
Send them on.
Send them on.
And we'll talk about it next meeting, you said?
Yep.
Okay. And the chair comments or thanks everyone for your patience in this very long meeting this evening, but exciting at the same time. Meeting is adjourned.
All right.